Right, in the life of Joseph. And I want to suggest, first of all, that I think that there probably is not a more thrilling character in all the Bible than Joseph is. But as we study the life of this man, there's one thing that I want us to look for especially, and that is to see the providential hand of God at work. There's not a story in all the Bible where the providence of God can be more clearly seen and understood, I think, than in the story of Joseph. There's a family living up in Canaan, less than 100 of them, and these people have within them that fulfillment of the promise that God made to Abraham. In thee and thy seed shall all nations of the earth be blessed. If that family vanishes from the earth, God's promise can't be fulfilled. And so when a famine comes along, God has to preserve that family. And in the story of Joseph, we see how God takes care of feeding that family, taking care of them, being sure that their lives are preserved. The interesting thing about the story of Joseph is the fact that there's not one sin laid at the feet of the man. Had you ever thought about that before? I'm not sure that I'd thought about it until I studied for this lesson. Not one single sin that I know of does God ever accuse Joseph of. And we're not proclaiming for a minute that he was perfect, because the apostle in the Roman letter said, there is none righteous, no, not one. And so we know that included Joseph, there were sins in his life. But God does not mention them in this particular book. But Joseph, with his faith in God, his determination to do right, we see him rise above some of the most trying circumstances under which a person might labor. In the life of Joseph, there are examples for both young and old. Most of us, or all of us in this assembly, are older people, but I tell you, we all can accomplish good as we think about the life of this man. He's 17 years old when the narrative begins, and then it closes, the narrative does, with the book of Genesis chapter 15, verse 26, by saying, so Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. One of the dictionaries, Bible Encyclopedia, says, here is one of the most brilliant pieces of literature in the world, a narrative full of gems. We challenge the world of literature to produce another that surpasses it. And I think that is not an exaggeration in consideration of the things that are found in the lesson. But we began with Joseph as a boy of 17, and you can notice the courage of this young man, not nearly mature as yet, but he's a young man of courage. He is a boy that's despised by his older brothers. There are 10 of these boys besides Joseph, then Joseph, and then there's one other younger boy, making 12 of them altogether. The younger boy doesn't enter the picture very much during the story, but these 10 older boys dislike Joseph with a passion. And there were a number of reasons for that. One of them was because of parental partiality. Joseph was loved by his father more than he loved the other 10 boys, and expressed that love and concern in an open way, so that there was a good deal of disgust on the part of these 10 boys toward Joseph. Ye fathers, provoke not your children to wrath, but bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. And parental preference will always result in trouble in a home. And parents need to be careful that they have the same love and treat their children in the same way. But a second reason that Joseph was despised by his brothers is that he tattled on them. He told his father about the wickedness of these boys. The Bible doesn't say what the conditions were, what the circumstances were, but Joseph went to his dad and told his dad about some of the misdeeds of these 10 boys. And then the third reason why these boys disliked their brother was because of the dreams that he had. You remember that he had this dream of being out in the field with the rest of them, and they were in the grain, and they were making sheaves out of the grain. And Joseph's dream was that their sheaves bowed down to his sheaf. And that didn't appeal to them very much when they considered the implications of that. And then the other dream that he had was of the sun and the moon and the 11 stars bowing down before him. They could understand very well who the 11 stars were, because there were 11 boys beside Joseph, and these boys are bowing down before Joseph. And so that didn't sit well with them. And so they developed a feeling of iniquity, a bad feeling toward Joseph. Well, These boys are out taking care of their father's sheep and some distance from home, maybe 60 miles away. And the father wants to know how things are going. And so he sends Joseph on a trip down there to find out. And that trip of 60 miles across country for a 17-year-old boy, I think, exhibited some courage. And telling his father about the misdeeds of his brothers, if it was going to help them, was certainly a thing of courage on the part of this young man. But when they saw Joseph coming, they said, "There comes that dreamer, and just let's take care of him." And the first thing that was suggested was that they throw him in a pit and let him die there. And the first thing was they were going to kill him, and then they were going to say that a wild beast had devoured him. And then Reuben was the one who suggested, "No, let's not do that, but let's throw him in a pit." And then Reuben had in the back of his mind that he would go and get him out of the pit and take him back to his father, restore him back to his dad. But they stripped him then and took that coat of many colors that his father had made for him, and which indicated his special love for the boy. They took that coat off of him and put him in that dry pit. But God did not allow that plan to be carried out. While they were eating, they looked up, and there was a caravan of Ishmaelite merchantmen coming down the road. And Judah came up with another plan. He said, "There's no use for us to be guilty of the blood of that boy, believing him in that pit to die, and let's just sell him to the Ishmaelites." And of course, out of that would be some money for these boys. And then another thing he was suggesting was that we're not going to have a killing on our conscience. And so they took him and sold him to the Ishmaelites for 20 shekels of silver. You notice how an old man's minds work. I was typing, got in 30 pieces of silver in there. And the King James says 20 pieces of silver. And I noticed the New King James says 20 shekels of silver. And certainly wasn't 30. So you want to scratch that out and make 20 out of it. But Reuben was ignorant of what had happened. And when he went back to the pit to get Joseph and didn't find him, he rent his clothes. And the Bible says that he said, "Where shall I turn?" And you and I might have said, "What in the world am I going to do?" And Reuben was upset because his plan to take the boy back to his daddy had been upset by the deeds of these other boys. But then these heartless boys took Joseph's coat of many colors and they dipped it in the blood of an animal. And then they took it back to their old father and they gave it to him without explanation. And he assumed the worst. He says, "An evil beast has devoured him." And then he said, "I will go down to the grave mourning for my son." And when you stop and meditate for a little bit, you can feel in your own heart the agony that must have been in the heart of this old man as he's lost one of the boys that he loved so much. But Joseph has been sold to the Ishmaelite merchantmen, and they take him down into Egypt, and they have the opportunity then to sell him to a fellow named Potiphar, who is a captain in Pharaoh's guard. And so here is Joseph now. He's a slave in a foreign land, but God was with him. And the Bible says that Potiphar could see that God was with Joseph. And God blessed the house of Potiphar because of Joseph. I thought this afternoon especially about the statement that Potiphar saw that God was with Joseph. And I don't think there was anything miraculous, certainly, about the statement. But you know, if people associate with us, could they say we believe that God is with that individual? I think there was a conduct about Joseph and the speech that he used and all of that. Just let Potiphar know that here is a man who believed in God, trusted in God, and God walked with Joseph, just like Joseph walked with God. But Potiphar thought so much of this boy that the Bible said he put everything that he had under his hand. And the only thing that he didn't have Joseph have control over was his own wife. You know, all this time, I suspect that in the mind of Joseph, there must have been sobering thoughts and discouraging things that came to his mind. He must have thought, you know, "I never did really do anything to those men, my brothers, and that they hated me with a passion, and they were going to kill me. Instead of doing that, they sold me, and I'm down here in slavery because of their wicked deeds." And another thing he may have thought of when he got down into Egypt was that it's an odd thing to me that my daddy hadn't come looking for me. It just looks like he'd have got up a party and began to search for him. And he didn't know they'd taken that coat of many colors and dipped it in blood and taken back the old man. And it was no wonder the old fellow didn't make any effort whatever to find his son, because he thought sure that he was dead. And so he may have sort of felt like everyone and everything is against me. And it's just no use to be try to be good anymore. You're going to gain anything by being good. You know, it's a worth, not none of those things entered mine. So far as the Bible goes to show. His faith was always strong, and there never was any indication whatever of the fact that he resented or wanted to turn his back on God or blame God or anything of that nature because of the difficult circumstances in his life. But then Joseph faced the low point in his life when Potiphar's wife cast lustful eyes on him. Joseph, I think, had faced the temptation of being proud when his dad had made a coat of many colors for him. And then when he had these dreams of the sun and the moon and the sun and the moon and the stars bowing down before him, and the fact that those sheaves bowed down before his sheaves. Here's a 17-year-old boy. Don't you think that he would be inclined to be proud and haughty? But there's no indication at all. But there was, I think, that temptation there for that young man to be proud. And then a second thing is that I think he was faced with the temptation of discouragement. I'm not saying he succumbed to it. But here was the temptation just to think that everything is against me. There's no use to try, and I'll just throw up my hands and quit. There must have been that temptation. But Joseph overcame, if it was, he overcame it and certainly did not succumb to it. But now here is the strongest temptation, without doubt, that came into the life of Joseph. The Bible tells us that Joseph was well built and handsome. That's the way one version renders it. Another says that Joseph was a handsome in form and in appearance. And so he was a nice looking young man. And Joseph's wife, or Potiphar's wife, is not what she ought to be morally. And she begins to look at this young Hebrew man, handsome in form and face, and she begins to lust for him. And day after day after day, she asked him to go to bed with her. And Joseph refused. He resisted the temptation. And when I use the word temptation, I'm not suggesting anything wrong on the part of Joseph. Jesus was tempted. The Bible said he was. But there was never anything sinful in the heart of Jesus Christ. And I'm not inferring at all anything wrong in the heart of Joseph, but there was a temptation placed before him. And there'll be temptations placed before us. But let a man say when he's tempted, I'm not tempted of God. For God does not tempt any man. God is not tempted of evil, neither tempteth he any man. But I suggest to you that there were elements in this assault on Joseph's virtue that would have proven to be overwhelming to a lot of men. First of all, the person behind the invitation to go to bed made the temptation, I think, a great deal stronger. You can imagine how much money this woman, Potiphar's wife, could have spent on clothes. And I suspect that in these times when she was tempting the young man to go to bed with her, that she may have very well dressed in provocative clothing. She must have been a very pretty woman with the money to be fixed up and all of that. And the temptation from that standpoint must have been exceedingly strong. And then to think of a young man like that, a slave boy, and here is the wife of my master who wants to go to bed with me. And that must have increased the severity of the temptation. And then the second thing is the constancy of it. You can ward off a temptation one time without difficulty, maybe. Then it keeps coming back time after time after time after time. And I think the danger increases, doesn't it? Wouldn't the danger increase with the constancy of the temptation? Just every day, nearly, she came around suggesting immorality to this young man. And then, thirdly, the convenience that was afforded to Joseph in this situation. Well, evidently, Potiphar was away from the house a good deal of the time. And there were times when the servants were out of the house. And so there was opportunity for nobody to know, except the two of them, that they'd gone to bed together. And yet Joseph did not succumb. And then a fourth thing that I suggest to you that made the temptation especially strong for this young man was the extra privileges that Joseph might have expected by forming that kind of a relationship with a woman. Just think of how many favors she could have bestowed upon that boy. Money and clothes and things just on and on and on that she could have done for that young man because of the immorality. But I tell you, Joseph showed a lot of character. And Joseph showed a lot of courage when he warded off the temptation, did not succumb to it, and the Bible doesn't indicate even any weakness in that direction on the part of Joseph. And I tell you, in this world, 1998 in America, we need more Joseph, don't we? Men, young men, and older men who will set the right example in moral principles and let other people know where people ought to stand and what the hell they ought to act as the people of God. But then I suggest to you another thing, and that is that human reasoning could very well have entered into this thing and made the situation even worse. Why not? Nobody will ever know. Nobody else is in the house, just her and me, and so nobody will know except us. That would be human reasoning. And yet, you know what? Joseph had a better mind than some people have in this world. He knew that God would know. The eyes of the Lord are in every place, beholding the evil and the good. And a fellow can run off to Chicago on some business trip and have an affair up there for one night or whatever and come back home and think that nobody knows and he can keep on waiting on the Lord's table, and that's so. Nobody knows but God, and that's enough. And I want to tell you, God knows what we do, and God even knows what we think. We don't put anything over on the Lord. But then another thing that Joseph might have thought from a human standpoint now, just think of all the things I've been through. Man, oh man, I was down there in that pit, and my life was at stake, and then they took me out of the pit and sold me to the Ishmaelites, and then they sold me, and I'm a slave boy, and it looks like I deserve a little pleasure. I put up with enough bad stuff, it looks like a little pleasure ought to be afforded me. But Joseph didn't reason like that. But another thing, from a human standpoint, I think, that could have very well have entered his mind was that if I don't please her, boy, she can cause me a tub of trouble. And she really could. And that was proven in just a moment, you know. And that could very well have come into mind. I better go ahead and go to bed with her, because if I don't, then she's gonna make it rough on me. But that would be human reasoning. But none of that entered into the heart of Joseph. But instead of allowing the flesh to rule, Joseph spoke the truth. And he said to her, "No one is greater in this house than I am. And my master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you are his wife. How could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God?" Isn't that a great statement? No one is greater in this house than I am. I'm the top man under your husband. And my master has withheld nothing from me except you, because you're his wife. How could I do such a wicked thing and sin against God? It looks to me like, let me suggest this, looks to me like that was a sin against Potiphar if he had done it. It looks to me like he would have been violating a piece of something that belonged to Potiphar. And it looks like it would have been a sin against Potiphar. Well, we're not denying that for a minute, but I want to tell you that Joseph hit the nail on the head when he said it's a sin against God. And there's where the primary sin lies. God made the rule. God made the law. You do not commit fornication. And when you violate the law, you sin against God. And men may be involved in some way, but God is the primary one who's involved in sin, because we've acted in violation of the teachings of the Word of the Lord. But on one day, when the two of them were there in the house together, the servants are gone, her master, her husband is gone, he's not there, and she grabbed him by the coat, and she said, "Come to bed with me." And Joseph did the right thing. He fled. And the Bible says, flee fornication. Every sin that a man doeth is without the body. He that commits fornication sins against his own body. Flee from it. That's New Testament teaching. And Joseph in the Old Testament times had learned the lesson well. And he let his coat stay in her hands, and he ran out of the house and did not commit sin. All of us know the story, the rest of it. A little bit later, the servants came in, and she called for them, and she showed them the coat and said, "He tried to rape me." That's what one version says. The King James says, "He mocked me." But all of us know that the other version is exactly what happened. And we've gotten to the place in life where we can use the word in a public place, and it's not objectionable. And that's exactly what happened. He accuses Joseph of rape. And so when her husband comes home, you can imagine the wrath in the heart of that man. I think any of us would believe our wife, unless there were certainly evidence to be otherwise. And he believes she's telling the truth. And here's this boy that I put my trust in and elevated him and put the whole house under his control and all of that. And he has violated my trust and tried to violate my wife. And he was so angry that he immediately threw Joseph in jail. In 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13, Paul said, "There hath no temptation taken you, but such is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted above that you're able, but will with the temptation also to provide a way to escape that you may be able to bear it." God will provide the way to escape. And every time we're taken in by sin, and occasionally we are, but every time we do, we fail to take the way of escape. There's a way to get around the thing and not do it if we just take advantage of it. And Joseph took advantage of it, left his coat behind, and ran out of the house. Joseph recognized that fornication was S-I-N, sin. Today, illicit sex is the order of the day. And I think maybe I said Sunday. I don't know, but I think there are a lot of younger people in America who don't even know it's a sin. I've had two Bible classes begin with a couples living together, not married, and I don't think they had any concept of the fact that anything was wrong. They came to church, and I met them and asked them for a Bible class, and I don't think they understood that sin was involved. And I dealt carefully with both situations and waited up until I get the fourth or fifth lesson so I could lay a good foundation of respect for Bible authority and then get into it. And I wasn't invited back anymore after that. But I don't think they understood at all before that they were living in violation of the law of God. Living together before marriage common. Divorce and remarriage without scriptural cause is rampant in the land. And all of it brings about immorality. In 1 Corinthians 6, 13, and I quoted a little bit a minute ago, "But now the body is not for fornication, but for the Lord, and the Lord for the body. God hath both raised up the Lord. He'll raise us up by his own power. Know ye not that your bodies are the members of Christ? Shall I then take the members of Christ and make them the members of a harlot? God forbid. What? Know ye not that he that is joined to a harlot is one body? For the two, saith he, shall be one flesh. But he that is joined to the Lord is one spirit. Flee fornication. Every sin that a man doeth is without the body. But he that commits fornication sins against his own body." What? "Know ye not that your body is the temple of the Holy Spirit which you have of God? You're not your own. You're bought with a price. Therefore glorify God in your body and in your spirit which are God's." I never have thought that I understood the passage, "Every sin that a man commits is without the body. But he that commits fornication sins against his own body." I doubt that I understand it. But you know, I know the Lord is saying there's no other sin in this world. Not another one like immorality. Every other sin is without the body. But fornication, when you commit fornication, you sin against your own body. And there's not another sin in this world that affects an individual, a man or a woman, young man or young lady, like immorality. It affects you spiritually, it affects you morally, it affects you socially, and it affects you bodily. In every way, immorality affects you. And I would hope that none of us, not one of us in this building, would ever, from this day forward, be guilty of immorality. And if we have been in the past, we need to be truly sorry, and make whatever amends are necessary to be forgiven by God, and begin to live like the Bible teaches. If we're living in a relationship in marriage that where there's fornication involved, we need to get out of the relationship, because going to heaven is worth everything in the world. And I tell you, when you get toward the end of life and look back, if there's nothing out there, it's been a bad trip. Joseph is in jail. He's thrown in there by Potiphar because he believed the lies of his wife. But in prison, you find Joseph is a humble and a patient fellow. He's in there being punished because of the lies that somebody has told about him. And the Bible says that when Potiphar's wife lied to her husband, he burned with anger. And so Joseph was the victim of slander. Joseph was the victim of lies, and that's why he was in jail. at that very time. And I want to suggest to you again that it would have been so much like human nature just to throw up his hands and quit. I tell you, I've been through it, and I've tried, and I've done the very best I can do. I was upright in life, and I stood for moral principles, and look where I am. That's what's got me, laying here in jail. But there never was a thought like that ever entered the mind of Joseph, so far as the Bible goes to show. James said, "My brethren, count it all joy when you fall into divers temptations, knowing this, that the trying of your faith worketh patience." And James is talking about the difficult things in life. And you count it joy when you have difficult problems, when things come in your life that aren't easy. You rejoice because the trying of your faith works patience or endurance. And it makes you better, stronger, so you can keep on going and not fall by the wayside and be lost eternally. Thank God. The Lord said, for the trying times in your life. Over in the book of 2 Timothy chapter 3 and verse 12. Yea, and all that will live godly in Christ Jesus shall suffer persecution. And the reason that Joseph was there in jail and suffering was because he was a godly man. If he had been an ungodly man, he'd have been free and riding in the finest chariots and wearing the best clothes. But he was a godly man, and the suffering came because of his godly man. He did not sink in the well of self-pity. He didn't say that nobody cares about him, not even God. But Philippians 4 and 6, be anxious for nothing. Don't worry about a thing. But in everything, by prayer and supplication with thanksgiving, let your requests be made known unto God. And the peace of God that passes understanding shall fill your hearts and minds through Jesus Christ our Lord. Well, down in prison, the Lord was with him. From day one, the Lord stood with him. He went through trying times, but the Lord was there all the time. And the Lord is with him in the prison. And the prison warden, not very long, but the prison warden thinks he'd never had a man in jail like that Joseph. And he just makes Joseph his second man in command. He's over the whole place under the prison warden. And then another thing occurs that's interesting and wrapped up in the providence of God is that there are two fellows in jail at the very time Joseph is, and both these fellows have in the past worked for Pharaoh. One is a butler, and one was his baker. Well, they both one night had a dream, and the butler dreamed that he saw a vine growing, and there were grapes on the vine, and he went over and squeezed the grapes and juice out of it into a cup, and then he carried the cup to the king. And there were three of those vines. He squeezed the grape, then took the juice to the king. And when Joseph interpreted the dream for the butler, he said that the three vines are 3 days. And in 3 days, you're going to be back in your old job serving Pharaoh. But the baker's dream was a little bit different. He had in the dream, he had on his head three baskets stacked up on top of each other. And in the top basket, there was bread in that top basket. And there were three of those baskets. And then in his dream, he saw the birds come and they ate the bread out of the basket. And Joseph, in the interpretation, said to the baker, the three baskets are 3 days, and in 3 days you're going to be taken out and your head's going to be cut off. You're going to die. And both of those dreams came to pass exactly like Joseph had said. Well, after Joseph had interpreted the dreams and the butler is ready to leave prison and go and work for Pharaoh again, Joseph made one request to the butler. He said, "Don't forget me when you get back in the palace. Don't forget what I did for you. Don't forget I'm here." But the butler forgot. But something else occurs that is interesting, and that is that Joseph eventually gets out of prison and becomes the prime minister of Egypt. But how in the world could that ever happen when this boy is down there serving a term in jail? Well, the butler, of course, is back there with Pharaoh and working for him like he used to in the past. And Pharaoh has a couple of dreams. One of the dreams that Pharaoh had was that there were seven cows came up out of the river, and they were big, fat, good-looking cows. And then in the dream, he saw seven skinny cows come out of the river. And the skinny cows ate up the fat cows, and the skinny cows weren't any fatter. And then the second part of the dream, the second dream was that he saw seven ears of corn, and they were really beautiful ears of corn, filled out and all of that, you know. And then he saw seven bad ears of corn, scrawny ears of corn, come along, and they ate up the seven good ears of corn. And after the seven good ears that ate, or the seven scrawny ears that ate the good ears, the scrawny ears weren't any better. And Pharaoh trying to find out from people what the dream meant, and nobody could interpret it. And so it was then that the butler said, I remember now. There's that Joseph down in jail that I was supposed to, you know, say a good word for, and I'd forgotten all about him. But now I tell you, he's the fellow that interpreted my dream and the baker's dream, and they both came to pass perfectly. And so he's told Pharaoh, there's the fellow you need to get a hold of, and he'll tell you what the dream means. And so Pharaoh sent for Joseph, and Joseph was brought out of prison and interpreted for Pharaoh the dreams that he had had. He told Pharaoh that the seven fat cows were seven good years, and there were going to be big crops and a lot of food and all of that, and the seven scrawny cows were the 7 years of famine that were going to follow the seven good years, and the seven bad years would eat up the seven good years. All the food that had been grazed would, of course, be gone, and the people would be starving and all of that. And he said, now the other dream about the ears of corn, it's just one dream, really, because it means the same thing. It's regarding a famine that's going to come, and there's going to be 7 good years and then 7 years of famine. And then Joseph told Pharaoh, now he said, if you're wise, you'll pick out a man who's capable, and you'll put him over the land of Egypt insofar as gathering food is concerned. And during these 7 years, this fellow needs to stack up food, you know, and store it and have plenty of food in stock. So when the 7 lean years come, then the Egyptians can be fed. And so Pharaoh said, I don't know of anybody around who's a better, wiser man than you are. And he said, Joseph, I'm going to put you over the gathering of the food in the land of Egypt. And so Joseph then became the prime minister of the land of Egypt. And at this particular time, Joseph was 30 years old. And by this time, he had married a wife named Asenath. And he had 2 sons, Manasseh and Ephraim. And so a good number of years have passed since the time he was 17 years old and was sold into slavery. Well, the 7 years of good come, and Joseph, in his wisdom, stacks up all this grain in storehouses in the land of Egypt. And then after the 7 good years have passed, the 7 years of famine come on, and people in other places begin to be on starvation. But the people in the land of Egypt had plenty of food because it was rationed out to them as they needed it. But now again, we come back to how we began. Here are the people of God up there in the land of Canaan, about 75 souls, and I won't want to argue about the number, but maybe about 75 people up there, and they're God's chosen people. And from that little group of people, the promise to Abraham has to be fulfilled. And if they starve to death, it's going to be a bad situation. Well, they're hungry. They need food. And so the old gentleman says to his 10 boys, he said, you need to go down to the land of Egypt and buy food. For he had heard that it was available down in the land of Egypt. And so he kept Benjamin at home. He didn't want Benjamin to go. He's his favorite boy now, and has a lot of stock in that boy. But he sends the other 10 boys down to the land of Egypt to buy food. And when they got down there, Joseph is the one who is in charge of this whole business. And so they have to come to Joseph. And he recognizes them immediately. He knows who they are, but he doesn't let on to them like he knows who they are. And he accused them of being spies. And as you read the story, I think about 5 or 6 times, I didn't remember counting me sure, but about 5 or 6 times at least, Joseph said, you fellas are spies, you are. And he talked pretty rough to them, you know. But they kept on claiming, no, we're not spies. We're the sons of an old man up there in the land of Canaan. And there's one boy with our father, and then there's one boy that doesn't exist anymore. And they told him the whole story. But he said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. He said, I believe you're spies. But he said, I'll put 9 of you in jail and let you stay down here. And then the one can go take the food back up there to the land of Canaan, and the old man and the old fellow and the rest of the family can have food. And then I want that one that goes back to bring Benjamin back with him when he comes. And he said, if he doesn't bring Benjamin, no more food. That's the end of it. Can't take back any more. You've got to bring that young boy, you told me. And I just want to know if you're telling the truth. If you don't have that young boy, bring him down here, and that will be proof. But then he changed his mind. He said, no, I won't put nine of you in jail. I'll just put one of you in jail. And then I'll let the nine go back there and carry the food back. And so he put Simeon in jail, put him in prison, and let the other nine carry their bags of food, their sacks of food, back to the land of Canaan. But he did an interesting thing. He put their money in the tops of their bag. And so when they were on the way home and had stopped to rest and eat and so on, one fellow opened up his bag, and there was the money he'd taken down to pay for the food. And it was true of every one of the bags. Joseph had their money put in the top of their bag. They didn't understand it. They were amazed by it. But they went on home with the food. And after a while, all of that food was gone. And the old gentleman said, you're going to have to make another trip back to the land of Egypt and get food. And the boy said, well, we're going to take Benjamin with us. And the old man said, no, I lost one boy, and I'm not going to lose Benjamin. You can't take him. And they said, Dad, there's no way we're not going to go. And that man was telling the truth, and he was pretty sure about it. You know, we can't even see his face. We get down there unless we've got Benjamin with us. Well, he put them off for a while, and they got in pretty dire circumstances as far as food was concerned. But eventually, hunger softened the old man, and he eventually agreed for them to go. And you know, Reuben and Judah are the two fellows that step in and try to ease the thing for the old fellow. It was Reuben who first of all said, Dad, if I don't bring him back, you can kill my two boys. And then Judah stepped in and he said, I will be surety for the lad. And he said, Dad, if I don't bring him back, you can blame me forever. And so with that, the old gentleman allowed those boys to take Benjamin and go back to the land of Egypt. But he gave them double money. And you said, did you take the money you took originally? Take double money and go back and take it to the house of Joseph. And when they got down there, they went to the house of Joseph. And Joseph brought Simeon out of jail. And and Joseph began to inquire about his dad. And he was overjoyed when he saw Benjamin. And he had to go into another room and cry for a little bit. And then after he'd gotten his eyes dried, Joseph came back in the room and had a meal for them. And the amazing thing was that when they sat down to eat the meal, Joseph set them around the table according to age. And you can imagine the amazement in the minds of these 10 boys. And when they had them sat around with the youngest and then the next oldest and right on down until every one of them seated there according to age, they had no idea how in the world that man was able to accomplish that. But he did. Then they're ready to go back to the land of Canaan. And so again, Joseph has their money put in the top of their sacks, and he provides food for them for the trip, so they won't have to eat out of the sacks. He gives them extra food for the trip. And then he had his servant to put his silver cup in the top of Benjamin's sack. And so the boys take off and they start toward home. And they haven't gone too far until Joseph's steward overtakes them. And the steward says, hey, fellas, somebody has stole Joseph's silver cup. And they said, none of us have stolen that cup. And you just look in any bag and all the bags, and we'll promise you that if any of us has stolen the cup, you can take him out and kill him. And so the steward began to go through the bags, and the cup was in Benjamin's bag. And boy, you can imagine how they must have felt when they found out that silver cup, and they'd said, you can kill whoever has stolen the cup. And so they have to go back to the land of Egypt. And when they got there, Joseph said, well, you all can go home. Take the sacks of food and go on home, and I'll just keep Benjamin here because he's stolen the cup. And again, you know, Judah was the one that began to plead. He said to Joseph, he said, our daddy's old. And he said, he'll never live through it. And if we get back there and Benjamin is not along, he's going to die. And so Judah again pleaded. He said, let me be the slave and let me be here the rest of my life. But you let Benjamin go on home. And then Joseph couldn't stand it any longer. He broke down and began to cry. And he said, I'm Joseph. I'm the one that you sold into slavery a long time ago. And those boys were, of course, completely amazed that they found that brother they had sold into slavery. And I tell you, the thing that I wanted to impress on my mind and yours at this particular juncture was the forgiving spirit in the heart of Joseph. He's an unusual man. And he holds no ill will, as you can tell. None whatever. With all the bad treatment that he's had. But I tell you, one of the things that made it easier for him to be that kind of a man was his faith in God and his recognition of the fact that he understood. He said, God has sent me ahead of you to provide for the family. It's God's hand that I'm down here, and it's God's will that I've been in this position, and it's God's providential concern for the people, my people, that I'm here and able to feed you. Joseph's faith in God and his forgiving spirit of those wicked men, unusual characteristics of Joseph. But then, before our time is gone, let me suggest to you last of all that you can see the faith of Moses in death. Over in the book of Genesis chapter 50, it is that I want. Genesis chapter 50. And the verses 24, 25, and 26. Last chapter in the book of Genesis. And Joseph said to his brethren, I am dying. But God will surely visit you and bring you out of this land to the land which he swore to Abraham, to Isaac, and to Jacob. And Joseph took an oath from the children of Israel, saying, God will surely visit you and shall carry up my bones from here. And so Joseph died, being 110 years old, and they embalmed him, and he was put in a coffin in Egypt. Joseph, in the meantime, has brought his whole family down, of course, sent wagons up there, and Pharaoh is happy to assist in the situation, of course, because he has so much love for Joseph. And all the Israelites are down there in the land. But when Joseph dies, he says, I want my bones carried up out of Egypt. And when you begin to get the whole story, you can appreciate the fact that there's not a greater demonstration of faith, I think, on the part of Joseph than in that simple request that his bones not be left in the land of Egypt. In Hebrews chapter 11 is God's Faith Hall of Fame. Man after man and woman after woman are mentioned there in several women are mentioned there in the book of Hebrews chapter 11 of being such outstanding examples of faith. And you know the context in which Joseph is mentioned? By faith, Joseph, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. There's a lot of things about the faith of Abraham and the faith of Moses and all of that in Hebrews 11, just verse after verse that talks about their faith. But so far as Joseph is concerned, one little verse, and that one little verse says that by faith, Joseph, when he died, made mention of the departing of the children of Israel and gave commandment concerning his bones. And why is that? Why would his name appear in the book of Hebrews chapter 11 and be such an example of faith because of what he did when he died? Well, in Genesis 15 and verse 18, in the same day the Lord made a covenant with Abraham, saying, unto thy seed have I given this land, from the river of Egypt unto the great river, the river Euphrates. You know what he's talking about? The land of Canaan. That was given by God to the Israelite people. And that's where they were going to be. That was their homeland. That's where Solomon built the temple and all of that. And you know what? Joseph knew that. Joseph knew that. And Joseph did not want his bones to be left in Egypt. He wanted them carried back to the land of Canaan, the land of promise that God had given to his people. He didn't want them to be left in the land of Egypt. And it shows that faith of the man in God's promises. There was no way that Joseph could know that God would carry that out. But Joseph, by faith, knew that that was the land where they were going to live. And he wanted to be buried in the land of God's people, not down there in the land of Egypt. And then Genesis 17 and 8, I will give unto thee and to thy seed after thee the land whereon thou art a stranger, all the land of Canaan, for an everlasting possession, and I will be their God. And so Joseph wanted his bones to rest in the land of Canaan after the resurrection. Now, we started out by talking about the providence of God in this book, in this story. And I say again, there's not a place in all the New Testament, so far as I know, or in all the Bible, so far as I know, that demonstrates how the providence of God works more than in the story of Joseph. A long time ago, Brother McGarvey, back in the later 1800s, whatever, preached a sermon on the story of Joseph. And what Brother McGarvey did was to start at the very end of it and then run back to the beginning of the story. And in McGarvey doing that, you could see so plainly the hand of God in every little step that was made. why was Joseph down there in the land of Egypt and over the whole land, and how could he be the one who could dish out the food and these people up there not starve to death in the land of Canaan, come down and buy it? And then he pointed out, well, he's up there because he told Pharaoh's dean. And then he tells Pharaoh's dean because